from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we have a lot to share, including a special compound found in the marijuana oil that can actually be better than any Alzheimer's disease drug. We're going to take an in-depth look at the mitochondria. Those are the little energy factories of our cells and the evolution of human longevity, a nice piece from Life Extension, and a lot more on health and nutrition. We have a guest in the second part of our program, Professor Melvin Connor. He's a medical doctor and a PhD, both from Harvard. We're going to talk about a biological and anthropological perspective. Are we beginning to witness the waning and possible end of male superiority? I think you'll find this interesting. Then, time permitting, a series of commentaries, including collective psychopathology and the U.S. police state methods. John Kovas from Countercurrents. And the yearning for the past, is human society regressing? Professor John Causey, Global Research. Also, we thought that Obama had vetoed the Keystone Pipeline. End of story. Not at all. Did you know that it didn't stop the Keystone from being built throughout the entire United States, just not across the Canadian border? They renamed it. And once they renamed it, it no longer was the Keystone. It was now called the Gulf Coast Pipeline Project. And it connects to Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline that runs from Alberta, Canada, to Cushing, Oklahoma. The southern route, the Keystone XL, was put into operation in January of 2014. So if the northern route were permitted, the company would be able to send more tar sands products over a shorter distance. So we didn't win anything. That's the game of politics. They make you think that something has happened that hasn't. So we'll get some insights from Julie Dermansky of De Smog Blog on this issue. And how many accidents have occurred over 8,200? More than 300 per year. Major accidents involving aquifers, rivers, towns, communities. So they can't say that it's safe. We'll get to that. Let's begin. A good study came out today. Less meat, more plants for healthier people on the planet. This was a coalition, and they presented their 100 organizations, prominent experts all got together, and with the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee under the authority of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Agriculture. These are federal guidelines. Now, historically, they've been completely, totally worthless. They're corrupt. Special interest groups control what goes into them. The people, more often than not, on these committees do what the big meat, big dairy, big sugar says. So if they say, put more meat in the diet, meat goes in the diet and it's officially sanctioned. The dietitians will then give you more meat if you're in a hospital, or if a doctor says, well, have more meat. It's federally regulated. It's what we are told to have. All of it is a con job. It's all lies. So finally, someone comes by and says, let's examine this. And these are groups like the Center for Biological Diversity, Greenpeace, and the Center for Food Safety. And they say, let's do it right. And it's a campaign called My Plate, My Planet. Quote, people on the planet will be healthier if there's less meat and more plant-based foods on our plates. Our diets, particularly the meat-heavy American diet, have a huge environmental footprint that not only threatens biodiversity, but also our ability to continue producing healthy, nutritious food today and in the future. And that was from the director of the Center for Biological Diversity. So now they're going to present this to Tom Vilsack, the head of USDA. He is the number one governor in American history supporting genetically engineered food. He is fully a card-carrying Big Agra spokesperson. So this isn't going to go down well. with him. So let's see what happens. But we don't have to wait for the government to tell us anything, because almost everything they tell us has been filtered. It has been adjusted to suit the needs of whoever paid for the information. And the fact is that we have been abused at every level of our society with information that we accept and trust because it's official. So what I'm saying is this: I never trust anything unchallenged that's official, ever. And as a lifetime activist, I've never seen them honest, even once. I don't care what it is. They're incapable of just telling us the truth, because there's always someone else who would not benefit if the truth were known. So what does this mean? It means that we have the power to take one day a week to start it. I believe that people have to start at a level that they can actually maintain. And just go meatless. No, nothing from an animal that day. Nothing. And replace your dairy with rice milk or almond milk. Replace your ice cream with a rice cream. Replace your cheese with a vegan cheese. And have more of the grains and beans, nuts and seeds for that day. And then see if you begin to see a difference, a better appreciation of the diversity and taste and usability of foods. And then take 2 days a week. And then the third month, 3 days. Until at the end of a year, you should be well on your way to being meatless. Then they don't have the power over you. So I would definitely consider that. And by the way, in all the protocols, on every kind of condition to help them with lifestyle, a meatless diet is the basis. Now, there's several issues when it comes to marijuana, and if you bring them all together, it confuses some people. So let me separate them out. First, the bad news. The bad news is, if you're honest and objective, and if you look for the scientific independent literature, you'll find that smoking marijuana on a regular basis increases the carcinogenic activity in your body substantially, even more than smoking cigarettes. So that's a negative. Separately, it has been shown in those who have been heavy smokers that you can create a full-blown psychosis and delusional paranoia. And they historically have thought this was transient, 2 or 3 days. I've seen it in friends of mine that it was permanent. In fact, one of my friends, I just had another friend just pass this week. He was the second friend I met in New York City. And wonderful, unique individual. He was so charismatic and always smiling. You just enjoyed being around him because he was so much fun and a great personality. But he chilled out all the time. He was always smoking. And then I started to see his paranoia, and I started to see the psychosis and irregular behavior, as did his children. And it got so bad at one point that we had to do a full-on detox, because his body just was deteriorated. He was ravaged with yeast and fungus and sores that would not heal. That was due to the impact of his body's immune system. So having helped get someone out of a mental institution who got in there because of heavy use of marijuana that was not transient and acting out, having helped friends and people close to me, as a scientist and as a humanist, I had to say, yes, I believe in freedom of choice. These people can do what they want. But there's just been this great mind game played by hundreds of millions of people that it can't be harmful. They're wrong. It is harmful. But on that level, I have over 118 studies I'm happy to share with you. And you can throw them away and say, well, I don't care. And that's what mostly people do. Because I'm never one of the people, even including my friend, when I finally got him off and got him detoxed, when he finally moved, he went back and regressed into this place where, you know, he might have been happy, but he was not healthy and he couldn't communicate with people. You know, he just passed this week. And he and his son and I communicated about this. He was just lost. And also, he went into dementia. which is not uncommon. So that's one issue. A separate issue is, should it be criminalized? Absolutely not. Should it ever have been criminalized? Should anyone ever be in jail for using or selling or distributing it? Absolutely not. It just makes no sense. On every level, it makes no sense. But we make marijuana illegal. And then we create a war on drugs. Well, let's see how that goes. Okay, all those who supported the war on drugs and our involvement in Mexico. All right. Well, more than 112,000 Mexicans have been disappeared or murdered in the last 5 years for our war on drugs. I guess that worked, didn't it? The outcome is 110,000 dead people, including over 100 journalists, and the total corruption of their entire federal police system, and violence in every area of Mexico. There is no safe place in Mexico, unless you're very rich. It's Russian roulette whether or not they decide that you're a target. And look at Colombia, and look at Honduras. Look around the world. Look at what fuels ISIS and the Taliban's illegal activities is opium. The largest yield in the world comes from this. But go clear back to the Golden Triangle and the airplane line that was owned by the CIA that flew heroin out of the Golden Triangle. So it's a stupid war, and reasonable, responsible people who ask, what is the outcome supposed to be? If we're supposed to get people by deterrence, by going to jail for long periods of time to stop using it, it hasn't worked, ever. Why not make it legal and at least bring some control into it and get rid of organized crime and get rid of the violence and help people who need help? That would be responsible. Other countries are doing it with success. But as long as we have Bill O'Reilly and other people who unfortunately were born in the wrong century, they should have been born in the Inquisition, they'd have been perfect because of their attitude, their megalomania, their sociopathic tendencies. But we don't have that today. So it's wrong for it to be illegal. And also, I realize people in Colorado who are listening now, this may not have occurred to everyone, but I'm sure it occurred to some of you, that if you no longer have it illegal, why in the hell don't you allow everyone who's in jail for having used it or sold it to get out of jail? Why keep them in if it's not going to put anyone else in jail, if it's no longer illegal? So let them out. And lastly, then, is there any part of marijuana that is healthful, beneficial, medically important? And the answer is yes also. Now, this is where people get confused. How can something be both bad if you're smoking it and good? Because, well, there are medical properties in it, lots of them. And these medical properties have been able to be one of the best single treatments for brain tumors, glioblastomas, for seizure disorders, and for other conditions in the body. So we have an enormous amount of good that can come from the medical applications of the cannabinoids and the other nutrients that are within marijuana, as well as rejuvenated an entire industry of hemp. There was a time when hemp was legal. The rope of hemp was stronger than any other type of rope. And hemp protein, hemp essential oils. So you could then take large areas that are now growing, let's say, soybeans genetically, and you could convert those into hundreds of items grown with hemp. It would be an enormous benefit to society. The latest study to support this is molecular pharmacology. And this is where they found a compound. We already know that it helps with rare muscular diseases, arthritis, seizures, and cancer. But there's a chemical in the cannabinoid family that impacts Alzheimer's. This was a study published in the Journal of Molecular Pharmacology. It's home because a lot of people in America are now suffering from Alzheimer's, and I predict that in the next 10 years, you will have more Americans suffering from memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS than you will cancer. That's how bad it's going to be. And we have not prepared for this at all. So what it does is this. The study found that a compound within cannabis harnesses two therapeutic properties ideal for addressing both the surface symptoms, meaning memory problems, and the root cause, brain plaque of Alzheimer's. It states very clearly that the compounds which normally account for the high, the delta 9 THC, competitively inhibit the enzyme acetylcholinesterase, as well as prevents this induced amyloid beta peptide aggregation, meaning the actual laying down of the plaque in the brain. And that's a key pathological marker of Alzheimer's disease. You look for the amyloid plaque. Here's what the study abstract says. Quote, compared to currently approved drugs prescribed for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, THC is a considerably superior inhibitor of A-beta aggregation. And this study provides a previously unrecognized molecular mechanism through which cannabinoid molecules may directly impact the progression of this debilitating disease, end quote. That's very positive. And again, I believe that in the upcoming years, we're going to find hundreds and hundreds of uses that would be beneficial. Now, for those of you who are still eating genetically modified soybeans, think about this. According to a late report, consuming genetically modified soybeans could be serious because of a transfer mutated DNA to milk and decreased birth weights of newborns. And so, for example, the dangers of genetically modified soybeans have been in our consciousness for some time now. But once you consume the genetically modified soybean, it can transfer in the body. It cannot be predicted what the outcome will be. And now they're starting to find all these bad outcomes, including in the milk that is given to the baby. One single nutrient is called out because it can outperform vaccines. This is from Natural Health. And it also ties in with yesterday's discussion on vitamin C and how goats can produce 100,000 milligrams a day, and they're the healthiest of all the farm animals, and how gorillas produce about 5,000 milligrams. So how much should we produce? If you're athletic, if you're exercising, if you're sick, if you have cancer, if you have any immune-related disease, you're going to need a lot more. And I mean a great deal more. In fact, what we found when we were working with people with full-blown AIDS and who were dying, that you couldn't even get vitamin C measured in the urine. The body was using it until you got them up over 50,000 milligrams, 50 grams a day. And the more you gave over, let's say, a year and a half period of time, the more the body rebalanced itself. Until time, 11 of the people who were on the very extensive protocol, meaning they were there 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, free treatment, by the way, they reversed all AIDS-defining illnesses. There wasn't they even tested HIV negative at the end, though they had been HIV positive before and up, and they reversed. Every single disease they had, AIDS-defining illness, was gone and stayed gone. And we brought these people to a press conference. They were on PBS with their medical records and their doctors, and not a single thing was done about it. No one cared because it went against the drugs, the pharmaceutical approach. It went against the money machine, and the money machine won, except for these people who are alive. And the people who are being treated with the money machine died. So vitamin C was one part, but a very important part. Here's the latest on this. Quote, Dr. Frederick Klenner's findings of vitamin C and its incredible ability on everything from polio to multiple sclerosis to reactions from venomous snake bites can be found in the papers and other writings he authored across the span of 30 years. His documented success stories fly in the face of conventional medicine, which calls for risky, invasive medical treatments like the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Based on Dr. Klenner's years of study, it appears vitamin C acts as an anti-infective agent and reducing agent, as well as an anti-clotting agent, an oxidizing agent, and an antihistamine. Let's take a look at some of the benefits of vitamin C in Dr. Klenner's years of medical research. Are you looking for real solutions for infectious disease, cancer and cardiovascular disease, hormone imbalances, and heavy metal toxicity? And here's what the oncologists, the naturopaths in the world, were beginning to become aware of. That Klenner did a lot of studies, and he had great results, but he couldn't get any media. The media was afraid to have him on to talk about what he was doing. I had him on, and he always had papers, and he always had patients, and he always had good charts. He wasn't a quack. He was a futurist. He was way ahead of this curve. Polio, quote, polio was reversed with vitamin C therapy. While others before him had theorized that vitamin C could play a role in lessening the effects of polio, it was Dr. Klenner who first gave polio patients doses equivalent to tens of thousands of milligrams of vitamin C every day. While Klenner had presented briefing of his findings on vitamin C and polio back in 1949 at the annual sessions of the American Medical Association, babies, children, and adults continued to be crippled or killed by the virus as others in the medical field gave his findings little notice. Klenner recommended giving the vitamin C dosage intravenously, but noted that the intramuscular route could also be satisfactory. By the way, I would disagree with that completely. He administered at least 350 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, a dosage equal to about 30,000 milligrams for an adult. According to Dr. Klenner, massive ascorbate treatment cured every disease of 60 polio patients under his care. None had paralysis, and all were well just after beginning three treatments, and by the end they were completely well. Dr. Klenner reported his findings, this time in the Southern Medicine and Surgery Journal, a great journal, by the way. Again, few in the medical community took notice. Then you have boost immune function and eliminate disease symptoms naturally. And there were ways of helping with everything from shingles. An example, to quote Dr. Klenner's success with the use of vitamin C to combat a number of infectious and toxic invaders is astonishing, including his published work with 8 patients with shingles. Each person was given 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C every 12 hours, and 7 of the 8 patients reported complete relief of pain associated with shingles within 2 hours of receiving the vitamin C. Overall, the patients received from 5 to 7 injections of vitamin C. Blisters associated with the shingles virus began healing quickly and were completely gone for the first 72 hours. Dr. Klenner's observations are supported by findings of other researchers as well, both before and after he had published his work. An earlier study reported success with 14 shingles patients receiving vitamin C injections. In a 1950 report, shingles completely disappeared in an astonishing 327 out of 327 patients just 72 hours after they had received vitamin C injections. Dr. Klenner's work did not stop with shingles or polio. A long list of illnesses, including pneumonia, hepatitis, measles, mumps, diphtheria, and the flu, were cured with use of vitamin C therapy. The key to vitamin C's effectiveness is the practice of giving enough for a long enough period of time. And while some chronic viral conditions may not resolve promptly, research has yet to identify an acute viral condition that vitamin C cannot eradicate, other than in patients with severe tissue damage and near death. For example, in pneumonia, patients, Klenner recommended at least 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenous every 6 hours for mild cases and higher for serious cases. And also with hepatitis patients, patients were able to resume normal activities in just 2 to 4 days after receiving about 30,000 milligrams of vitamin C. So just some additional research from a remarkable pioneer who is completely unknown today, who published a lot of work. He was an Orthodox doctor by all other measures, except when it came to being the first physician outside of Albert St. George, who I also interviewed, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering vitamin C, ascorbic acid. But he didn't use it at high doses. It was Klenner who first used it at high doses, and that's in the 1940s and 50s. So just a look back, because it should be used today. It could be helping a lot of people. That's the latest on health and healing. And now I want to take a few moments and go over some other issues as well. For example, I want to share with you what happens to a community that allows fracking companies to get contracts without first doing really good geological surveys to see how much water do you have there. Do you have enough water, let's say, for the next 20 years for all farming and industry and the local town people? Because if you don't, the last thing in the world is you want to bring in a gas hydrofracking company, because the laws of many states will favor their getting your water even if the citizens are running dry. This is from Climate Progress and Samantha Page. Quote, a $600 million fracking company just sued this tiny Ohio town for its water. Quote, a tiny town in eastern Ohio is being sued by an Oklahoma-based oil and gas company that bought more than 180 million gallons of water from the town last year. That water use combined with dry fall prompted the village to temporarily shut off the water to Gulfport Energy. Now a second company has a water agreement, and there might not be enough water to go around. So there's a tiny town of 4,100 people, and they're being sued by this $600 million company because they're saying, hold on a second, we gave you $75,000, that water is ours. Okay, so, but there's a dry spell, there's drought, we don't care. You should have done your homework. It's our water. So that's just one example of what's going to be happening all over the country. And guess who's going to win these lawsuits? The oil companies. And especially in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Texas. Oklahoma and Arkansas, they'll win because they went in first and did all their lobbying at the state level to make sure they got exactly what they wanted. Now, this is an interesting piece from Julie Dermansky of DeSmog. Obama's veto of Keystone XL bittersweet for Texans forced to allow the pipeline on their land. Quote, as expected, President Obama vetoed the Republican bill attempting to allow TransCanada to finish constructing the XL tar sands export pipeline. While the veto received praise from environmentalists along with encouragement to reject the pipeline entirely, the veto provides little consolation to those in Texas who already have the southern route of the pipeline moving Canada tar sands under their land. Quote, don't get me wrong, I'm thrilled that President Obama owned up to his promise to veto the Keystone XL pipeline bill. But in the same breath, I'm spitting mad. Julie Trigg, Crawford, Texas landowner, who fought TransCanada from taking her land by eminent domain, but lost. Quote, for nearly 3 years, with the exact same data in front of him, he decided to cut through the red tape and fast track, we're talking about President Obama now, and the southern leg of this project. Where was his climate test then? Before the ink is dry on the veto, President Obama owes all of us in Texas and Oklahoma an explanation, better yet an apology, end quote. So here's what the American public and the environmental movement is not aware of. In the constant clamor from high-profile environmental groups, from President Obama to reject the Keystone XL pipeline, there was no mention that the president fast-tracked the southern portion of the pipeline, nor do most people know that TransCanada is already transporting tar sands from Canada to the Gulf Coast. Did you know that? the southern route of the Keystone XL, renamed the Gulf Coast Pipeline Project, connects to TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline that runs from Alberta, Canada, to Cushing, Oklahoma. The southern route of the Keystone XL was put into operation in January of 2014. Who knew this? If the northern route were permitted, the company would be able to send more tar sands product over a shorter distance, but a ban on constructing the northern route does not stop pipelines across America from transporting tar sands to refineries and export terminals. So while the battle to stop the Keystone XL's northern route was being waged, Enbridge, another Canada corporation, created its own pipeline, and it runs from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. Like TransCanada, Enbridge connected lines to make a pipeline pathway from Canada to the Gulf with the intent of reaching the global market for tar sands products. And Enbridge's Alberta Clipper Line 67, Flanagan South and Seaway Twin pipelines make up the Keystone clone. And so therefore they're getting it there. We thought it was dead. We thought our lands were protected. We thought no more eminent domain. We thought no more opportunity for a pipeline to burst and destroy aquifers, including the biggest aquifer in America, the Okalaba Aquifer, that covers 8 states. So that's where we're at. And finally, just to let you understand that this has been going on quietly, this is the latest from Deidre Fulton. Fossil fuel industry is quietly building pipeline network that dwarfs the Keystone XL. Quote, despite public opposition that has so far blocked the building of the Keystone pipeline, the fossil fuels industry has successfully and quietly expanded the nation's domestic oil network by installing thousands of miles of pipeline across the country. According to the Associated Press, quote, overall the network has increased by almost a quarter in the last decade, and the work dwarfs Keystone, about 3.3 million barrels per day of capacity have been added since 2012 alone, 5 times more oil than the Canadian to Texas Keystone line could carry, end quote. And while the Keystone project is still in limbo, the northern part, petroleum industry has, quote, pushed relentlessly everywhere else to get oil to market more efficiently, and its adversaries have been unable to stop other major pipelines. And that's not to say they haven't tried. In Minnesota, for example, a local opponent succeeded last year in getting state regulators to consider rerouting a 606-mile pipeline proposed by Toronto-based Enbridge around lakes and forests, delaying it for a year. But in the end, they still went ahead and built it. So, in conclusion, opposition to local pipeline projects is ongoing, good, but they're still building it. Didn't know it. 8,700 significant accidents in the United States pipeline involving death, injury, and economic and environmental damage since 1986. That's 300 per year. So the oil and pipeline industries are lobbying hard, and they're getting it their way. So you thought we had a victory. We didn't. So let us go back and reevaluate how we can stop this. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a look now at the biological and anthropological perspectives of the possible end of male superiority. Think that's just too much to hope for, or not even possible? Let's see. Let's speak with Professor Melvin Connor. He is a PhD and MD. He is the Samuel Chandler Dobbs Professor of Anthropology and Neuroscience and Behavior Biology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He received his doctorate in biological anthropology from Harvard, having done field work with the Kalahari Bushmen in Africa and later received a medical degree from Harvard Medical School. He's the author of 8 books and many peer-reviewed papers. His latest is a particularly controversial yet provocative and important work. It is entitled Women After All, Sex Evolution in the End of Male Supremacy, which questions our cultural assumptions of maleness and the superior status it has been afforded by our male-dominant society, and advocates for the raising of women's status to bring sanity to our world. His website is Melvin Connor, that's KONNER.com. Nice to have you with us today.
It's great to be with you, Gary. Appreciate it very much. Well, I don't know what I have to do now yet, because you've summarized everything so clearly just in your introduction. Thank you for that.
While there continues to be much that remains about DNA and genes and how genetics contributes to both health and disease, even those of us who have looked carefully realize that we don't know everything about genes and how they shape our identities, including maleness and femaleness. It is certainly not all mind over matter. Just 10 to 15 years ago, we were still calling about 90% of our DNA junk that didn't do anything. Now new discoveries are forcing us to completely reassess what they seemed like the right understanding, but today is erroneous. And likewise, a dozen years ago, epigenetics was only starting to enter more popular medical vocabulary, and that is radically changing the older paradigm of genetics, particularly what I call determinist or reductionist genetics. So perhaps we can start there, because science is observing many changes occurring particularly in the male chromosome, and also particular traits found in certain male conditions contributing to a shorter lifespan and sterility and mental problems, including a hypersexuality. Please speak on these characteristics that are more frequent with men, and what does that tell us about the resilience of men compared to that of women?
So your characterization of this, the new things that we've learned about the genes, Gary, is perfectly right, and it has forced all of us in the biological fields to rethink things and revise our lectures and how we teach about the genes. But on the specific question of male-female differences, and I use the sort of trope half-seriously of X chromosome deficiency syndrome to describe maleness, and the justification for that is that first of all, in evolution, every cell was originally capable of producing life out of itself. And so you could say the original organisms were all female, and also because in embryonic life, in humans and other species like ours, we start out with a basically female developmental plan in the womb, and then the Y chromosome comes along and sends out certain signals that create a male, and then basically divert the path of development to maleness. It's not the whole story, but that's the biggest part of it. And part of the result is different brains, and we're learning more and more about male female differences, not just in genes, but in the brain. And these are not so. So favorable to men every time, at least. And in fact, interestingly used the term male superiority coming to an end, and when you started, but then the title, as you say, is about the end of male supremacy. And I personally don't think there ever was such a thing as male superiority. There was male supremacy was a successful attempt by men to convince women and each other that men were superior and that women couldn't do most of the things that needed to get done in this world. And that is the, you might say, a male conspiracy that started 10 or 12,000 years ago, and that's coming to an end. And when it does, as it does come to an end, I think we're going to see the differences between male and female brains actually improve the world for our grandchildren, because, among other things, male brains have a larger area that deals with that produces violent impulses. That's called the amygdala, larger in men, and also very responsive to testosterone, which is, of course, the male hormone, and males have something like 10 times as much of it as females, and their brains are bathed in it. In addition, women studies or recent brain imaging studies are showing have a more active part of the brain that inhibits the amygdala, which produces the violent impulses, and that's called the frontal lobes. They're just more active in women, and so women aren't on a hair trigger of aggression, at least not physical aggression, the way too many men are. And the people always mention the women who have come to power who haven't been exactly peaceful, like Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi, Golda Meir, Angela Merkel, and so on. But I have two things to say about that. First of all, those women prove one thing, which is that men were completely wrong when throughout history when they said women can't do this, women can't lead, women can't run countries. They were wrong, and they've been proven wrong. But the other thing is that although you and I might not like the politics of those women leaders, part of what they had to do to get to the top was to climb up an all-male pyramid, and they sat on top of that pyramid while they were running their countries. And I think it's going to be a different world when we really have a lot of women infusing the hierarchy at all levels. And I think we see the result, for example, in Norway, where they've had two women prime ministers from opposing parties, and where about half the cabinet has been women for quite a while. And these are, I always like to point out, these are the descendants of the Vikings, one of the most violent male cultures that ever has existed. And they're a wonderfully peaceful country, interested in promoting prosperity and basically ruling in a transparent way that's much more inclusive than we see in some male-dominated countries.
I appreciate that overview. How artificial are the gender roles that are supported in modern civilization for most men, and especially those who view male-female roles within a religious context? These set roles are perceived as natural or even foreordained. Based upon both biological and anthropological evidence, how natural are these roles? And then what is the alternative gender role relationships that we should be considering?
Great question. I don't think they're natural, and I think the reason is that I've studied hunting and gathering peoples who were if there's anything any kind of human society that's natural, it's them. And I lived with the Bushmen and as you said in southern Africa for 2 years, and there are many other hunting and gathering groups in the world, and we've learned a lot from them. But one of the things is that sex roles are more egalitarian in that type of society. It's not because men don't want to push women around. They do. Men everywhere seem to want to push women around or get control of women or at least get their sex drives resolved by women. And the hunter-gatherers are no different. But the difference is that the men couldn't democracy in such a small scale society. It's a small, you know, these are bands of 30 to 40 people, including children and the elderly, and there's no real specialization of roles in society. And decisions are made by people sitting around the fire at night, talking and expressing their views, and women express their views too, and they get heard, and they can't be ignored because they're contributing a lot to the bringing home the bacon, so to speak, bringing home the vegetables and fruits and nuts, and that's the steady part of the diet, and they're raising children, and they're smart, so they have good things to say in those debates around the fire about what we should do about moving to a different part of the desert or savanna, or what we should do about the marital conflict that so and so has gotten involved in, and when you have the rise of civilization, the dawn of agriculture, you have an increase in population density. You no longer have small scale populations, and you start having specialized roles like specialized military, specialized priesthood, specialized, we'll get back to that religion thing, and a specialized merchant class, a specialized nobility that dominates everybody else. And that's when you could have a critical mass of men who could exclude women. It's when this is the first time you have a difference between the public space and the private space, and the men were able to take over the public space and exile women effectively to the private space, to the home and the kitchen and the children, and didn't have to listen to their voices anymore. And one of the places this happened was in religious hierarchy. So we know, you know, in every part of the ancient world, we have the rise of so-called civilization, is how I like to put it. You have an increase in violence. You also have a priesthood which is thoroughly dominated by men, and which uses symbols and rituals to create. To basically put forth an ideology of that includes male supremacy, and in some religions today, we see that ideology of male supremacy continuing.
In an enormous percentage, I just came with two thoughts here, and it'll probably take the remainder of our program to answer it. I'd like for you to explain to us why male-dominant societies tend to be so hierarchical and non-egalitarian. Right now, the media is frequently reporting on one new case after another of rape and abuse of women on college campuses, and these are particularly happening in the old boys' clubs, better known as the fraternities, which intentionally exclude women and therefore have a kind of hierarchical male superiority stamped in their purpose. And since women are usually confined to lower tiers on the social ladder, what does that tell us about the degree of fear men may harbor towards women, and does fear contribute to the history of abuse men have inflicted upon women, such as lower job placements and wages, servanthood and slavery, date rape, forced clitorectomies, harems, and other forms? All of these are forms of abuse. Then I'd like for you to address that, if you would, please.
Sure. I agree on all counts. There has been a famous case of a fraternity that was falsely accused at the University of Virginia, but that doesn't change the overall picture very much. You're talking about my students and my daughters, so it's. It's something that strikes close to my heart, and part of the reason I wrote this book. But what's happening in colleges is a very serious problem with date rape and acquaintance rape, and also this hookup culture that kind of grades into that. And I think, you know, what I wrote about in the book was studies of that hookup culture and this idea that women want casual sex. You know, young women want casual sex as much as young men. And you know, I'm not saying that there aren't young women who want casual sex. I'm just saying that this has been greatly exaggerated and to the advantage of the men. I think that if you look around our society, and it's particularly a problem among college students, maybe in our kind of society, because, and high school students too, is they're just forming their ideas of their identity. They're forming their sexual selves. They're experimenting. That's what they're supposed to do. But I think that clearly young women are being taken advantage of and abused in many situations. I think that if you go to the developing world, then you don't see this kind of abuse treated as an anomaly. You see it treated as normal, and it can be carried to really terrible extremes in some countries. And you know, the problem of rape and gang rape in India, the behavior of men in organizations like ISIS and Boko Haram. These are, and then you know, whole countries where women are not allowed to drive, or where in India, 4 out of 5 children who are not in school are girls, and those things are all having to be addressed in the near future, and I think they are being addressed. I mean, you have. I like the example of CARE, which used to be famous for the care packages that it sent to needy people in certain parts of the world. They reoriented their entire program about 10 years ago to girls and women, to educating girls and empowering women. And they are... Are doing that in so many different ways, so many different parts of the world, and I think it's becoming increasingly clear that the best way to spend an aid dollar is on educating a girl, because she grows up to make sure that her own children of both sexes are educated, to have better health, to have smaller families with. A smaller family with healthier children. Even her husband is going to be healthier as a result of her having more years of education. And she's going to be more resistant to male abuse.
Well, I appreciate all these insights. I had one last area, but we're not going to have a chance to talk about it, and that is the idea that men are intrinsically violent by nature. A form of violence that we never talk about in our society is financial and banking violence, meaning where you intentionally use an economic principle or system against someone else without any compassion or care for how that might impact them. You make money, they lose money, you gain something that you probably don't need, and they end up suffering and you don't care. That, I think, at some point we should be addressing in our society. You address all these wonderful topics that we need to go deeper into in your book. Thank you very much. The book is Women After All. My guest, Professor Melvin Connor, K-O-N-N-E-R. Nice to have you with us today. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Wow, I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that.